Coming up on Tech Nation, it turns out that YouTube is a whole lot more than just videos. Bloomberg and Business Week journalist Mark Bergen writes about the challenge of keeping up with the hundreds of hours of video uploaded every minute, and a surprise for the most watched videos. Take a guess before you hear it here. Then an excerpt from Wired Science editor Kara Platoni's original interview about her 2015 book, We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, and Physicians Are Transforming Human Perception. It's even more relevant today. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In 2013, I spoke with Harvard psychology professor Mazarin Banerjee about her book, Blind Spot, Hidden Biases in Good People. Don't think you have any hidden biases? Hint, they're hidden. Professor Banerjee credits her interest in biased research to the work of Yale professor Marcia Johnson, who measured unconscious bias in people suffering from amnesia.
It's exactly work like that that got me interested in this topic. I did not come to the study of unconscious bias by worrying about things like race and gender and so on. I was busy as a graduate student studying human memory. And when I was in the early 1980s doing that kind of work, a little revolution was happening in the field of memory. People had begun to discover that for 100 years, psychologists had measured memory by simply asking people to report back on some prior episode. They would say, you know, can you remember where you lived when you were 5 years old, or what did you eat for breakfast? All of these are very conscious, deliberate ways of reaching back into our minds to pull out some information from the past. And amnesic patients really don't have any of it in different forms. The severely amnesic ones really can't even remember the face of a doctor that they might see every day. And yet they seemed to remember certain things. And that was, for me, a revelation, because if that was the case, not only in amnesic patients, but later shown to be true in all of us, then what would that say for how we go about remembering our attitudes? Do I even know what my preference is? Maybe I don't know what it is. And that was, so Marcia Johnson's study was one of several studies that got us thinking about how you can both know and not know something in the same mind. So here's what she does that's so interesting. She gave people, amnesic patients, and then a control sample of people who had more intact memory. She gives them faces of people to look at, and with each face, she presents a little description of this person. This person was in the Naval Academy and received an award, or this person was in the Air Force and had to be dishonorably discharged. Let's just take those two as examples. Well, later, when you ask amnesic patients, tell me, when you look at this face, can you tell me anything about this person? They would say, absolutely not. I don't even remember seeing this face before. And yet, if you said to them, look at this face and tell me, is this person a good person or is this person a bad person? And it turns out that with close to 100% accuracy, if you had said, awarded a medal for bravery versus dishonorably discharged, they would, with close to 100% accuracy, say good or bad accurately. Now, that meant that something did remain in their minds, and it was an important piece of information. It was whether to remember that this was somebody to approach or avoid in the future, even though they had zero recollection for the face. You ask yourself, why, at the end of a 30-minute interview, do I love this person so much? Or why do I find myself being agitated by this person? And you might ask yourself if something that happened in the first few moments set you up on a path whereby all you're doing is simply reinforcing the first impression that you had formed. And at the end of 30 minutes, all you've done is made sure that you have evidence for that very first feeling that you had.
This Archive TechNation interview features Harvard professor Mazarin Banerjee and her book, Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. Professor Banerjee continues to study thinking and feeling as they unfold in social contexts, with a focus on mental systems that operate in implicit or unconscious mode. Her courses include The Nature of Prejudice and The Social Mind. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is TechNation. Today on TechNation, we discover that YouTube is a whole lot more than just videos. Bloomberg and Businessweek journalist Mark Bergen talks about his book, Like, Comment, Subscribe: Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. Then, continuing the impact of technology all around us, we revisit Wired Science editor Kara Platoni's 2015 book, We Have the Technology: How Biohackers, Foodies, and Physicians Are Transforming Human Perception.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Mark Bergen. Mark, welcome to TechNation.
Thanks for having me.
Now, by now, I think everyone knows that people post videos on YouTube. And as the name of your book suggests, Like, Comment, Subscribe, everyone is, I think, familiar with, well, you post videos out there, but it's much more than that.
Yeah, the title's meant to hint at this idea that YouTube has really invented that transition from watching television as a sort of lean-back passive experience to an active engagement. And they really wanted, and the first to encourage viewers and audience to participate and, you know, comment beneath videos, to subscribe to their favorite creators, and like the like button and all the different signals that YouTube uses. And of course, this becomes the data points that the company, rather than doing traditional programming like we imagine has worked for decades before, it is programming by machines. It is programming by computer algorithms, and that is dictated by all these viewing behaviors. And a lot of this is kind of pretty well understood by people that watch YouTube. But I think a lot of it operates in the background and behind the curtain, so to speak. And my attempt from the book was just a very important, influential platform and company that hasn't really been a story that hasn't been fully told.
Well, 2 billion visitors every month, second only to Google, its parent company, 450 hours of video uploaded every minute. And in terms of impact, 25% of Americans rely on it for news. In a real sense, it's replaced television.
Oh, absolutely. And for a younger generation, it's even more. There was a recent study from Pew looking at U.S. teens and their use of social media. One of the big takeaways there is that they did this study in 2014, and then fast forward to do it to this year, and teens are not using, surprise, surprise, not using Facebook as much. They're using TikTok a lot more. It was like 67%, I believe, teens said they used TikTok on a regular basis. 95% said they use YouTube. It is just for an entire generation of people, and this is not just here, but across the globe too, especially in places where they sort of didn't have a TV in every home, YouTube becomes that primary screen.
Many people that listen to the show are familiar with Facebook. How does YouTube differ from TikTok?
Oh, good question. So YouTube is it's been around for long. It's been around just as it started sort of a few months after Facebook. It started in 2005. It joined Google in a year later in 2006. And it has since then, in the past decade in particular, really built this system for longer videos. A lot of the sweet spot here for like 15 to 20 minutes. These are the ones where, you know, YouTube's business model is advertisers are going to pay to get in front, run a commercial in the beginning of a video, sometimes increasingly in the middle of a video. And so what that created, the business model incentives there were longer videos that had never been on before on the web and on the internet. And that has birthed just all sorts of wild niches and everything from going on. You probably go on YouTube, right, to do your like learn a new yoga routine, to learn how to fix your sink, to watch a music video, to hand your phone to a toddler to occupy their time and be a babysitter. The library, it is like Google in the sense that it's just the repository for every video sort of imaginable on the internet. And in that sense, TikTok has come along much later. It is clicked into something that YouTube kind of neglected, which is short form video, videos that are pretty easy to produce on your phone. Now, some of the most successful YouTube videos are shot and operated almost like TV and film with that sort of production budget and cameras. And TikTok is much more of the mobile generation and Gen Z. That's something that YouTube is now like seeing in their rearview mirror and trying to address.
And would you say TikTok is more in the 15-second to 20-second, did I get that right, length?
Yeah, sometimes they go longer, up to a minute. And I think, you know, TikTok is now exploring like what they call longer form video. It's like 5 minutes and 6 minutes, sort of funny that that's considered longer now. And this was early YouTube was like TikTok. It was actually like some of the most successful early YouTubers were making these really high production quality, inventive short films. And like short skits and like playing around with this canvas in a way that it's hard of difficult for us to appreciate. But this was, you know, 15 years ago, there was no guarantee to make money on YouTube or make money producing video on the internet. Now it's sort of taken for granted. But this with the company and the early creators were kind of pioneering in this space. And as the book lays out, there weren't a lot of safeguards in place as well, which had some pretty big ramifications.
Now, I have to say, you don't have to watch technology too long to realize that it always converges. So the YouTubers are looking at TikTok, the TikToker are looking at the YouTubers, and there are other people looking at both of them that they've never even heard of before. everything converges over time. And yet you did mention it in terms of how YouTube makes money. Let's talk about how much money it's made. And how money gets to creators.
Yeah, so YouTube, the first part of your question, last year in 2021, they disclosed that they've, in their earnings, that they made close to $29 billion in advertising revenue, which is remarkable in the sense of like the earliest data we have from YouTube that they disclosed was 2017. That was around $8 billion. They also make an additional amount of money, a smaller amount, but from people that will pay $10 a month to get YouTube Premium, which is you can get a music service that's similar to Spotify. And one thing for people like me that watch a lot of YouTube for personal and professional reasons, you don't see ads, which is a big blessing for watching a lot of YouTube. So, and they also have a TV service, like an over-the-top sort of streaming TV, like an Apple TV service called YouTube TV. But most of their money is made from ads. And since 2007, they were a pioneer of this on the internet. They've been sharing revenue with their video producers. So typically YouTube will, for every dollar that's spent, every time an advertiser gives them money to run a commercial, YouTube will take 45% and give the remaining 55% to the video creator. Now that gets complicated when we talk about like managing different rights for music and like YouTube built the system for copyright. So if you intentionally try to pirate some video footage that's owned by a media company, that YouTube system is in place that media company will get the money for that video and that IP.
Well, it does bring us into influencers, and who is, and I'm going to mispronounce this, PewDiePie?
Oh, you actually got it.
Oh, it's right. It's right. It's called, let me spell it for you. It's P, capital P-E-W, capital D-I-E, capital P-I-E, PewDiePie. PewDiePie's made some bucks here.
PewDiePie, he's a character in the book. Felix Kjellberg is a Swedish YouTuber, really like early trailblazer in the genre of, it's called Let's Play, is what they call it. It is a critical part of YouTube's success, video game footage, in which he was this genius at making these compelling videos for that he often would play a video game and simultaneously, you sort of film his reaction to it. Twitch, which is owned by Amazon, is an entire streaming platform largely devoted to this. And YouTube was, I think, one of the first to kind of make this mainstream. PewDiePie becomes a fascinating character in YouTube's history. Starting in 2012, he had the most subscribers of any YouTube creator. This big star, he sort of always pushed the boundaries a little bit, like in his satire and his responsibility. And there's this, his incident in 2017 started off probably the worst year in some of these series of crises that YouTube has gone through, and these dramatic changes to how the company and the platform works. And it's like a really fascinating drama. And I think that's like part of the book is just going into that.
But he did make millions of dollars.
That's right. Yeah, he's made millions of dollars off YouTube. He's,
tens of millions. Tens of millions. Just being him.
yeah, it's I think there's a really interesting, which I touch on in the book a little bit, like, you talk to people who work in sort of with YouTubers or like around YouTube culture, and there's a sense that like they used to talk, they say that, one marker of success for them would be once a YouTuber has the mainstream recognition of, say, like a George Clooney or a Brad Pitt. And so part of it is it's difficult for people to conceive of, the richest YouTuber right now by many calculations is a 9-year-old. I believe he's 9. Ryan Kaji, who got his rose to fame on YouTube, toy unboxing, largely. Like he was growing up as a kid, filming a lot of videos with him playing with toys. And he's like a very charismatic kid, clearly doing something that's compelling to an audience. I think it was Reg Forbes had his net worth from YouTube at like $30 million a year, building out this sort of franchise of kids content that doesn't appear on TV and film. These are stars. They're media personalities. YouTube as a company, for a long time, as the book shows, wasn't accustomed. Like Google is just not like one that's built to manage talent and to deal with the complexities of building out like what it means to have a media business and have celebrities, and they launched thousands and thousands of careers like that without a lot of like infrastructure in place to deal with the pressures of fame, which we all are familiar with, and the new sort of pressure of fame that YouTube introduces, which is that your fans not only know you, but they think that they know you personally, which is this really fascinating phenomenon that YouTube created. And I don't think we've quite grappled with as a society.
Bring in the psychologists. We have to explain this. I mean, we got to find out, a whole new thing of know thyself. I don't think I don't think the Greek philosophers really had this in mind, but here we are. There's a bunch of people saying, I just don't have anything to do with this. And it's like, well, PBS NewsHour, big YouTuber, big YouTuber. And frequently, you talk to, celebrities and they say, 100 million followers. And you're like, what difference does that make? Now we know why.
Yeah, it is embedded itself in the culture. I think most, and this is, maybe I'm jumping ahead of the question too. Like, there's been a lot of scrutiny of Facebook, as you and your listeners know, and the consequences that the platform has had on democracy, right? On addiction, on how we like relate to one another. YouTube is not often brought up in those conversations, but the same dynamics. It has similar dynamics, right? YouTube's dealt with conspiracies. They've dealt with misinformation. They've had a hard time policing hate speech, harassment, you name it. Part of the reason that it hasn't had as much scrutiny, and the book is sort of a call for like, hey, let's pay attention to this important thing, is because most people's, whether they're journalists, politicians, regular people, their interaction with YouTube is often as a utility, is sort of in the background. They just, whenever I can go on, I can find this clip. And it is this marvelous archival instrument, right? Like, I'm still shocked the amount of, I love jazz, and like, oh, wow, there's this footage of Miles Davis playing in like 1962 here, like that, and it lives for free on the internet, right? And that had profound, that's profoundly changed the way that media works in the business of media, and Hollywood is still sort of frantically adjusting to that. But I think that that it serves both a role as this repository and library, and at the same time also has a lot of problems around political speech, and a lot of problems around like how people characterize different religions and faiths and communities, and all the sort of ills that we're too familiar with now.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Bloomberg and Businessweek journalist Mark Bergen. You may know him from his long-term coverage of all things Google, as well as technology and media for Recode, and business and economics from India for such publications as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. He's here today with Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. Well, you mentioned Facebook and you mentioned religion. You opened the book with a mass killing inside a mosque in New Zealand. Now, describe what happened and how it relates to YouTube.
Yeah, this is just this visceral moment. And so this was in 2019, in March of 2019. It was a shooter, a white supremacist, who went in to a mosque and another Islamic center in Christchurch, New Zealand, and murdered 51 people, and live streamed the act on the internet. And this is something that, you know, was unfathomable a few years ago, and now is easy to do because of the way that these platforms work, right? They've built a way, and YouTube was, the context here is that YouTube at the time was like trying to compete with Facebook, which was, had its live feature. And so they were kind of prioritizing live videos. That video actually like wound up on Facebook Live, which was a YouTube competitor. And then it came on YouTube, and the company, you know, had there are people at the company, both that work there, and then they have a bunch of like outsourced contractors that have to sift through a lot of this footage. And once it's flagged as violent, to determine, you know, is this, they have like a lot of elaborate written rules about, you know, is this is violate our rules about graphic violence and hate speech. Like clearly that they decided that video did, you know, the other kind of collateral damage, it's often if it's archival or news value, the company sometimes wants to keep that on. You know, there's interesting examples about the Syrian war, where sometimes like YouTube is the only place in the internet and in the world where they have these valuable records of devastation and human tragedy. And so the company's trying to balance that. And so this was a tragedy. The other reason that it implicated and drew in YouTube, there were two. One was the shooter, what he said before the act was subscribe to PewDiePie. And so PewDiePie at the time was the world's biggest YouTuber. There was this meme to sort of defend him after he'd had a couple rocky years. From the reporting I've had and others, the shooter was not like a PewDiePie fan at all. This was a catchphrase that was just viral, and it was meant to get attention. And we've seen this really dark pattern repeat itself in Buffalo more recently. But the New Zealand government did a report afterwards and said, you know, they came out from their analysis of the terrorist saying that he was influenced by ideas that he'd watched on YouTube, and this notion that immigration and Muslim immigrants in particular were this strong threat to Western society, and these dangerous rhetoric and ideas that had spread on the internet for a long time. And after that moment, it was a major turning point when YouTube then introduced new hate speech rules and said in videos, you can't go out and make comments about a protected class and a group like Muslims or immigrants. And that's dramatically changed. They've since deleted, you know, many channels and videos that were doing that. But this is a continuously difficult problem that the company sort of set up, which is the whole premise of YouTube is that anyone can broadcast themselves and then anyone can make money from it. And so now in the past 17 years since starting, they've been trying to clean up the damage from that system.
Well, YouTube's recent brand mission for a number of years was give everyone a voice and show them the world. And when you invite all of humanity, you get all of humanity.
That's right.
And how you control it, how you disinvite, you know, particular voices or messages, it isn't easy if you're getting 450 hours of video every minute. And unlike a restaurant.
I think the recent number is 500, actually.
Ah! Jump to 500. Oh, no. Yeah. So unlike a restaurant, you can't post a sign which says no shirts, no shoes, no service. Is filtering out undesirable content even technologically possible?
That's a really good question. The difficulty that YouTube has, when we take a step back, is that unlike Facebook and Twitter and other parts of the internet, text is relatively easy to analyze. Video is much more difficult for like our current machine learning systems and software because it includes text sometimes and audio and visual, and it has, you know, it's just longer and meatier problems. So my understanding is that Google is the world's largest and most powerful artificial intelligence company. And even they, you know, I had this a quote in the book from a senior executive there is like, he's like, you know, people think that because we have self-driving cars that we can solve this problem. It's like, sometimes we can't even tell what people are saying in a video. So that is a problem and then YouTube wants to solve things with machine intelligence as much as possible, in part because they know that, you know, relying on humans, makes them susceptible to, Donald Trump and other Republicans have accused him of conservative bias. They want to steer clear from that as much as possible. It is dramatic work moderating the internet like this. And so I think they want to rely on fewer people as possible. You know, stats that YouTube says is that their machines are able to identify videos that violate the rules. Over 95% of them can come down just by machine intelligence. But a lot of the trickier areas, you know, I was talking about the great replacement theory, which is this right-wing notion that, and white supremacist notion that immigrants are a threat to white society. And so conversations about immigration and like YouTube is really hard to train machine to say like you, that the fact that I brought that up right now, like, am I endorsing that philosophy or am I just discussing it as a political framework? Right. And so YouTube, you know, they opened up the world in which not everyone, you don't have to have a news anchor. You don't have to have a cable TV show. You don't have to have a newspaper to be a media personality or a media company. And the ramifications of that are who's a media company, right? And so these are decisions that even if they were able to build up the world's an artificial intelligence system that could identify every time I say a particular word or move my hand in a particular way, it is up to human judgment to make decisions there.
I'm speaking with Mark Bergen, the author of Like, Comment, Subscribe, Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. We'll talk more after a break. The Biotech Nation podcast individually can be found at biotechnation.com and separately subscribe through your favorite podcaster, including Amazon. Podcasts of whole Tech Nation programs continue to be available on NPR One and other podcast outlets. In the second half of our show, more about how science and technology are changing us or helping us find who we really are. Wired Science editor Kara Platoni talks about her 2015 book, We Have the Technology. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Bloomberg and Businessweek journalist Mark Bergen. His book is Like, Comment, Subscribe: Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination.
Even if they were able to build up the world's an artificial intelligence system that could identify every time I say a particular word or move my hand in a particular way, it is up to human judgment to make decisions there. And that's sort of what I wrestle with that in the book. And I want readers to get this idea that you know, there are human beings at this company making decisions, even if they're making those decisions in code, that are important and worth scrutinizing.
And so what's nightmare fuel?
Oh, God. Nightmare Fuel was one of my main characters in the book. Her name is Claire Stapleton, and she worked on the marketing team at YouTube. And I think the marketing team at YouTube is deeply fascinating for a variety of reasons. One is, so Susan Wojcicki, who is YouTube CEO, was Google's first marketer and a very good marketer. And YouTube is, well, YouTube's a marketing company, right? It works. Its business model is selling ads. And it's actually, it's like a pretty decent. It cares a lot. People in the company care a lot about the brand and the integrity and how people outside of YouTube view YouTube. Nightmare fuel was a term that some people in the marketing team came up with for this daily, I think it was daily, sorry, regular email they had. That was, one of the issues with YouTube is it's just so vast, and that the team started around 2017, 2018. This actually started when a famous YouTuber named Logan Paul, some of your audience may know him, he's now a famous boxer, shot a YouTube video in Japan in which he showed a man who had committed suicide kind of hanging in a forest. And this is one of a series of like disasters for YouTube. It happened during the holidays, and so a lot of people weren't working there. And after that, the company's like, okay, we need to keep tabs on the most outrageous things that were happening on the site, the kind of things that our marketing team just needs to know about, which is a totally like smart and savvy thing to do. But for the employees I spoke to, they called it nightmare fuel because it often had this this way of making them think that their platform just reflected the worst parts of humanity.
It's such an incredible ride. And then you find out these little bitty, you know, pieces of information and about the decisions made, such as removing the count of dislikes on the dislike button. What's that about?
That was a recent decision. I guess we could maybe take the simplest explanation there, where like YouTube is under pressure, and I think the employees themselves like they want to see the internet as like a positive place. They want to see YouTube as a positive place. I think there are people there that if they could go back in time would never have introduced the thumbs down button on a video. And that's what a dislike is. The other context here was, I believe the record for the most dislikes on a video before that was actually a YouTube, like YouTube's own video. Their company has their own account. And they made a video in 2018 that it was YouTube Rewind, their yearly feel good video where they like do all the caps, kind of a recap of the year with all the creators. And at this point, it was like one of the low points for the company's relationship with its creators and their fans. And that video began with Will Smith, who everyone in your audience probably know, who is most decidedly not a YouTuber, right? Like this was something that I upset a lot of YouTubers, and understandably, like they also had John Oliver on there, right, and the host of The Daily Show. And that was one dynamic. The second one was YouTube was growing so internationally, and I think the book spends a lot of time on the U.S. and just because I, you know, could only tell like a certain amount of stories, but YouTube is gigantic in India. You know, has as many monthly users there as there are people about in the U.S. Like, just think about that. Huge in Brazil, huge in Russia, huge in Japan, Korea, Mexico. And so what this video did was it started to introduce, because YouTube was trying to appeal to global audience, introduce creators from all across the world. And if you're like a dedicated fan of a certain YouTuber here in the US, and they're like, why is this? I don't know this YouTuber there, you know? And so I think this, I thought it was there's a whole chapter in a book that unpacks this for a moment of like this, it's really telling time in the company's history where, you know, what's the, that phrase, the lunatics taking over the asylum kind of thing. Like, it felt very much out of their control. It became the most disliked video. They stopped doing the YouTube rewind from then. They've also, you know, their justification for taking away the dislike button, which is, totally, understandable, is that it, yeah, YouTube has been this force for harassment for a long time, and misogyny in particular. And so there are people that will go out and like trolls that will dislike, flood a video with dislikes, that the, what happens then is it buries the, you know, the more dislikes a video, that's like a bad sign of engagement. So it's less likely to appear in your search results and your recommendations. And so it's effectively a way of like killing the traffic on a video. And I think YouTube saw that happen enough. They were pretty late. They were very late to responding to harassment, particularly from female YouTubers and LGBTQ YouTubers. But this is part of their attempt to address that.
You really get the picture that there's a lot of dynamics that they are trying to figure out 24/7 every day for the last, you know, almost two decades now. You do say, you do point out that YouTube content is primarily creators, music labels. We can see that. You want to see a lot of music out there. And traditional media. I did mention the PBS NewsHour, but all of them have a big presence on YouTube. How many creators do they have?
Oh, God. Oh, that's a really good question. I'm sure that someone at YouTube knows that answer.
Yeah, I didn't see it, so I was like,
I think the most recent number they listed was, so they have the partner program is what they call the way for, if you are in the partner program, you can make money off your videos. And I believe the most recent stat was 3 million now in the partner program. So that's 3 million channels on YouTube that are making money. Now that I'm fairly certain also includes the, you know, Jimmy Kimmel's, like the Taylor Swift's, like the big traditional media. That number is smaller than what it was a few years ago. So the book, one of the arcs of the book is this, they made this decision in 2018 to dramatically reduce the number of creators. I think it was, my reporting is like maybe twice that many that were making money, which is at the time and still is like the largest sort of internet economy there's ever point.
Ever.
Period. That's right. Yes.
There you go. Ever. Now, we haven't talked about Susan Wojcicki, YouTube's longtime CEO. We haven't talked about a lot. But I want to ask you this one last question. What don't the baby boomers know about YouTube that everyone under 30 does?
That's a really good question. Mr. Beast? You think that your audience knows Mr. Beast?
Mr. Beast? Sure. I think mostly they don't.
he's right now probably the most popular YouTuber. I will answer that two ways. So that, yes, there are figures like that who are, Mr. Beast is young. He's under 25. He's has over 100 million subscribers and is sort of like the hot YouTuber at the moment, in part because he's incredibly popular and he's so far not done anything to flaunt, like to put YouTube in hot water, for it's like a godsend for the company, right? And so they just had him at their most recent advertising conference. I think the thing that I would say that most people not even under 30, that most, if you go on, so there's a site called TubeFilter, which is a really great resource for me. And it's like a billboard for YouTube, sort of. They keep track of the most popular YouTube videos and they constantly update, and it's a really reliable place. If you go on the TubeFilter and look at the most popular YouTube videos by traffic, by views, it is consistently videos for children, for under five. It is nursery rhymes. That is, feel like the top channels are all videos that are designed for your 5-year-old, your 4-year-old, your 3. And I think that's something that the company has took a long time to come to terms with and actually admit. And it's, I don't think it's something that's registered in enough for people that YouTube is the world's biggest kids entertainment service by far. And it's very understudied. Talk to researchers, right, and pediatricians and experts in this childhood development. It is unclear what the what's the impact of having, you know, YouTube raise our children.
Well, there you have it. You're a parent. You got kids. You gotta, you know, do something. No, the baby boomers didn't know that, well, but they know it now. and we also have many listeners that go right down to that, you know, mid-20s. So they're all like going, yeah, yeah, you found out. It's true. We got to keep these kids managed, you know. So it's amazing.
Yeah, I think the other thing about that's unique about YouTube is it doesn't, most people probably don't know who runs it. And the people, like, it's not like Facebook, because Mark Zuckerberg, or for better or worse, is a known entity. And the book is an attempt to take people inside the actual human beings and decision makers at this important place.
Mark, thank you so much for joining me. And we've got plenty to discuss. I hope you'll come back and see us again.
I hope so, too. Thanks so much.
My guest today is Mark Bergen. His book is Like, Comment, Subscribe: Inside YouTube's Chaotic Rise to World Domination. It's published by Viking, an imprint of Penguin Random House. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. In considering how we individually and collectively are being changed by such social media entities as YouTube, it's important to remember that all technology changes us. Wired science editor Cara Platone talked to this precisely in her 2015 book, We Have the Technology: How Biohackers, Foodies, and Physicians Are Transforming Human Perception.
I know it says we have the technology on the cover, but I wanted to make a big argument that technology is not just gadgets and computers and things that light up. Technology is anything that we as a people have made to be useful to us, to help us. So in my book, I say that the technologies that affect perception are not just wearables and implants and gadgets and all these cool 21st century
sci-fi things. We get a lot of those books
sci-fi things.
Where,
yes, I know. But tools like language. Language is a technology. In my book, I have a chapter that's about perfume, the science of smell. Well, chemistry is a technology. I have a chapter about pain, and the technology in there is Tylenol, or rather the generic acetaminophen, this idea of a painkiller that alters how we feel pain. So, yeah, technology surrounds us all the time, and there's a lot of things that we just accept. We don't even think about them being technology anymore. You and I, we're eyeglasses wearers right now. Well, a lot of the people I spoke with for my book would argue, well, that basically makes you a cyborg. You're wearing this prosthetic that alters what you can sense. It gives you superpowers. Well, most of us don't think of the eyeglasses as being this radical technology. It's just something that we've adapted to. It's something that's so interwoven into not just everyday life, but actually we think of it maybe as part of our face that it just seems normal to us.
Like having your iPhone or smartphone.
Oh, gosh, yes, right?
It's an extension of my hand.
Yes, and not just an extension of your hand, but an extension of your memory, an extension of your ability to communicate with other people. I hadn't really thought about how intimately the iPhone was a part of my life until I started researching this book. When I was exploring other more novel gadgets, more radical gadgets, things like, you know, smart glasses and the idea of implants or other extra things you could add to your body. And then people I was talking to started saying, you know, you're already carrying around this portable device that has amazing surveillance technologies, capabilities. It has amazing tracking abilities. It has a camera in it. It allows you to communicate with somebody anywhere on the planet anytime you want, and it's in your pocket, and you don't even notice that it's there.
I have to say, for the first time ever, I realized that the players on Star Trek would be envious of what our smartphones can do.
Yes.
Never thought of it that way.
They get to be in space, so I still think they have the edge up on us.
Well, let's start with pain. You were talking about Tylenol. I remember UCSF psychiatrist and neuroscientist Amir Levine. He was talking about a broken heart and how it really is physical pain, and that Tylenol really does help. Of course, you also say, you know, if you just ask a bartender, you'll find out the same answer.
Right. Oh, this was so fun to learn about. But there is actually quite large body of research right now that says to your brain, the pain of social rejection, the pain of a broken heart, and physical pain, the pain of a broken bone, are essentially the same thing. It's the same part of your brain reacting in the same way. And so, just as you were saying, there are researchers who've done these really interesting experiments where they put somebody in an fMRI scanner and they give them Tylenol or the generic acetaminophen, and then they socially reject them. And it's actually really hard to socially reject somebody who's lying in an fMRI scanner.
I don't know. I feel like I'm at the dentist's office and I feel totally rejected.
They're just, you know, they're lying there. They can't move. So the first wave of experiments, what they did, and this actually seems really horrible to me, but they showed people pictures of somebody who had recently broken up with them. So you had to look at the picture of your lost love. And then in the next wave,
stab in the heart.
I know, right?
And then the fMRI is looking at you. And the fMRI sees that your brain moving, and it's not just one shot.
It's tracking brain activity, kind of using blood flow as this proxy for seeing which neurons are active. So it's showing this real-time picture of what's going on, which regions of the brain are active. And they're seeing that the pain regions are lighting up when people are socially rejected. And then in the next generation, what they did is they had people lie in the scanner and they said, okay, you're going to play a game. It's called cyberball. The idea is we pass the ball back and forth. After we've passed the ball back and forth, the computer starts leaving the person out, starts passing to these other imaginary players, right? Well, the person doesn't know that this is just a program on a computer. There's no other real players, but they still feel rejected. And so in these studies, they found that people who were taking the acetaminophen, the Tylenol, felt less rejected. Then some other researchers came along and they said, okay, let's try this in reverse. Let's see if love is a painkiller. So what we're going to do is we're going to put people in the fMRI scanner and we're going to give them a physical pain, an actual slight burn. It feels kind of like a sting. And we're going to do this while they're looking either at a picture of their romantic partner or at a picture of an equally attractive stranger. And lo and behold, love is an analgesic. It reduces the amount of pain that people report that they feel as they're staring at the photo of their beloved.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
I'll tell you, science is getting into all kinds of things.
It is. Well, so for this, I wanted to write not just about academic studies, and of course, it's very hard to observe someone in an fMRI scanner. There is just, you just see their toes as peeking out from the machine. So I wanted to find some people who have experience with the pain of rejection in real life. And I thought, well, I could interview therapists, but there's patient confidentiality rules. And plus, that would be a very gloomy interview. So instead, I went to bars and I hung out with bartenders because I thought, who knows the pain of romantic rejection and offering advice to strangers.
They could all write books.
More than the
bartenders. Yeah,
they were fantastic. The bartenders I talked to were wonderful. And I thought, it is not a coincidence that bartenders are dispensing, you know, a legally available painkiller, alcohol, right?
Yes.
Along with that romantic advice. So I had a lot of fun talking to people about the pain of rejection and whether it is as real to you and feels as painful to you as the pain of an actual physical wound. And there's actually a pretty interesting evolutionary biology explanation for why this might be so. So the idea is physical pain is a warning sign. It tells you stop doing the thing that you're doing. It's injuring you. It's bad for you. Same thing with social rejection. If people are stepping away from you, if they don't want to be involved, is probably because you're doing something that is bad for the group. It's putting your personal bonds at risk. And humans, we're social animals. We need other people. So we need a warning sign that says, hey, knock it off. Stop doing that.
And also, anecdotally, I thought the bartenders came up with some interesting frameworks. They say, women come in, they talk about this. Guys come in, they talk about that. Let's go there. What do they see as a pattern?
Yeah, oh, well,
I presume you went to a lot of bars, a statistically significant number of bars.
Well, how many would it have to be statistically significant? A 1,000?
No, 30. 30, I'll do it.
No,
yeah.
I did not go to 30 bars. I went to three, and two of them are in the book because
Wow, one of them was just so good. One of them was one of my local bars, the Nightlight in Oakland. And the bartender and owner there, John Knackley, just turned out to be an amazing philosopher of broken hearts and lost love. And so what he was saying is, when women come in, they're always picking his brain, saying, why did the guy do this? What's he thinking? What's going on? And when the guy comes in, he just says, she left me. You know? And I was asking him, hey, what about other forms of social rejection? Do people come in and they want to talk about the job they didn't get, the team they didn't make? And he said, oh, it's love. That's what people care about. That's what they want.
Drives them to alcohol.
And to conversation. You know, it's kind of funny. The bartender is sort of your captive audience, right? So people really pour their hearts out to the bartender while the bartender is pouring them a drink. And I thought, who else in our society does this? Who else might be in this position? And the one person everybody suggested was hairdressers.
Oh my God. Right? Isn't there confidentiality with your hairdresser?
A clause?
You would not believe what I and all of my female friends tell their hairdressers.
Yeah.
Barber's probably not the same thing. Well, I don't know.
Maybe. I think the salon and the bar are these public spaces where people feel comfortable talking about things of the heart in front of other people. And the bartender and the hairdresser are just people that you trust, people you open up to.
Hairdressers, 6 weeks. It's like, well, what's happened in the last 6 weeks? Whoa!
Exactly.
Same thing. So let's talk about another chapter, one that's familiar to us all. It's an overwhelming sense when you're young. It can diminish over time. It can stop with a medical condition. And yet it's much integrated with our brains and our whole being. That would be the sense of smell.
Oh, I loved researching this. This was one of the first things that I got started on. And I kind of stumbled across, by reading science papers, I stumbled across this fact that shocked me. I had no idea, which is that loss of smell is the first clinical symptom of Alzheimer's. It's also a very early symptom of Parkinson's disease. I had no idea, but I started looking into this body of work and I thought, how could this information be of practical use? And it turns out there are people who are thinking very creatively about how to use this. And one group of people says, look, a smell test for Alzheimer's would be a great early indicator. It would be a non-invasive test. It would be cheap. A scratch and sniff test would be something you could easily take to a developing country where there's not a lot of infrastructure for medical testing. It would be a wonderful early warning sign for people who are having problems, and it might even help us diagnose people earlier and develop better treatments for them. So I thought, oh, that's really interesting. So one part of my book is I went to see a man at the University of Pennsylvania who has developed this amazing, almost like an obstacle course of smell tests. And once every month, his lab lets non-smelling members of the public come in and do this kind of round robin of tests that he's invented, smell tests that he's invented, including scratch and sniff tests and this amazing test where you kind of put your face in this, it looks like the diffuser of a hairdryer, and it blows a scent like rose oil at your nose. All of these cool tests that he's developed for early diagnosis of smelling problems. And then the other group that I talked to was this amazing group of women in Paris, France. They are all members of a group called Cosmetic Executive Women, and they are women who work either in the cosmetics industry or are retired perfumers. And what they are doing is they are using smell as a way to help people with Alzheimer's recall lost memories. So what we did is we went to the geriatric ward of a hospital. And Anne Camilli, who was my host that day, who had trained as a perfumer, has a very sensitive nose, had the sense of 10 fruits. And she would open this little glass vial and dip a little paper wand in, and she and her assistants would wave it under the noses of the people in the ward, and she would say, Madame, what is it? And the people would guess. They would say, I think it is orange, and I think it is lemon, right? And sometimes a person would have a memory to share. And the women who run this program say, it is amazing the memories that pop out for people. They told me this story of a woman, 99 years old, who they gave her the scent of orange blossom. And she said, this made me remember going to Tunisia as a young woman on a day that they were harvesting oranges. And she told them the story about the orange blossoms in the trees and how at the time men and women had to walk on opposite sides of the street. They told me the story of a man who was a retired banker who didn't talk. And then one day they gave him the scent of wine. And all of a sudden he launched into this long story about being on a tasting tour with his wife. And the women in this program said to me, and with Alzheimer's patients, you open a drawer and a little memory comes out, and then a few minutes later the drawer closes again, and that's it. The person doesn't recall having talked to you. It's just been this moment of pleasure, this moment of communication. So they invite family members to come and to participate because they say it is a way to remember that your loved one is still that person that you know. That person is still in there. Their tastes, their memories are still in there. And there's a scientific reason for why smell is so evocative. In fact, scientists think that smell is probably the first sense that any animal had, not just humans, any animal. We're talking all the way down to single-cell organisms. This thing that they call a chemical sense later became smell and taste for us. Even for very primitive organisms, it was something that said, that's good, eat it. That's terrible, don't touch it, it's poison. Or, you know, that's your species, go mate with it, right?
Yeah.
And this evolved into the sense of smell. So it's a very old section of the brain that synaptically is very closely connected to memory and emotion, and it brings up all of these feelings. So the neat thing about the idea of what they call olfactotherapy or smell therapy is that it works even for people who have a neurodegenerative disorder. And I should say, please don't freak out if you don't smell as well as you used to, because all of us, our sense of smell dulls a bit as we age. That's normal. So one of the things that they had developed were a sense they called alerts, which were things like the smell of leaking gas, because they wanted people to be able to recognize that. But interestingly enough, there is a similar program happening right now in Singapore, which is a country with a totally different kind of smell palette, a different cultural idea of what smells are salient to you or fond memories from childhood. So while the French group had developed the smell of wine and bread, and they had even developed the smell of blood because they were working with hospital patients and wanted them to be able to talk about trauma, the group from Singapore had developed things like curry and tamarind and the smell of the seashore. And they had even done the smell of opium, because a lot of elderly people grew up in a time when people did smoke opium, and they had developed the smell of the fireworks that people use at Chinese New Year and all of these wonderful evocative smells. And they told me a wonderful story about how they had given the scent of jasmine to a man who was of Indian descent, lived in Singapore, but was of Indian descent, because they said, jasmine is a beloved smell. It will bring back good memories. And when they gave it to him, he said, oh, it's roses. Well, it wasn't. It was the wrong memory. He was having trouble distinguishing between the two smells. But they said, that's okay. What does roses remind you of? And he said, girlfriends. And they said, oh, what does that mean? What is girlfriends all about? And he told them this story of how, as a young man, all the boys at his all-boys school would buy flowers for the girls at the convent school across the street. And that is the magic of smell therapy, I think.
I've been speaking with Wired Science editor Cara Platone. Her 2015 book, We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, and Physicians are Transforming Human Perception. It's published by Basic Books. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.